Les colloques du Collège de France.
I'm very happy to introduce Professor Nama Friedman, who is the Branko Vice Chair of Child Development and Professor in the School of Education and Sagol School of Neuroscience in Tel Aviv University. Nama is an amazing person who has won several awards, including the Michael Bruno Memorial Award and the Michael Landau Prize for Science and Research. I think I could say a lot of anecdotes. Nama has become a very personal friend. I say just one thing. Nama, you must have seen something like more than 1,000 cases of developmental disorders. I think you know them all by name, by date of birth, by who are their sisters and what are their first names. And so you have an exceptional mind for caring about the person as well as caring about the science of what we can learn from these cases. So we look forward to hearing from you. It's wonderful that you're here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this. Thank you, Stan, for this, these warm words. And with respect to birthdays, you can look here and think about this operator. Maybe you can figure out what it means, this new operator. It's a beautiful festival. Thank you very much for organizing this science festival, brain festival. But it's a challenge to be awake after at this time. So I'll talk about syntax, and this will wake everybody up, right? Because nothing is as nice as syntax. And I'm going to show you how, actually, I see syntax everywhere. Maybe you'll start seeing syntax everywhere. Because when we look at developmental impairments, at acquired impairments, in various domains, we see that syntactic theory is a very, very useful tool to explain what we see, as well as to develop treatment procedures and to learn about the brain. And when we talk about seeing syntax everywhere, I also mean about people who see syntax everywhere they go. So, for example, here you might think we will talk about mountains or maybe rivers, but we actually talk about syntax. And this is one of the exciting things about STEM, that you really embrace complexity and you love syntax. Some people say, okay, I will not mess with syntax. Syntax is complex. Stan says, I will work on syntax because it is complex. And the way Stan looks at various domains and really enjoys them, including syntax, for me is inspiring. So thank you, Stan. It's a pleasure to collaborate with you and to learn from you. And today we are going to talk about syntactic movement. And we're going to talk about the way this theoretical construct is very useful in explanations and in treatment. So as you can see, I'm very ambitious. It's very appropriate for the hour. But I'm going to be relatively short for each part of this talk. I'm going to talk about how this construct of syntactic movement is very useful in explaining acquired impairments after stroke, developmental impairments, how we can understand why some individuals have language impairments from childhood or from birth. I'm going to talk about MRI, so brain and language, and what we learn from MRI to clinical populations. I'm going to talk a little bit about various kinds of neurodegenerative disorders, and then I'm going to talk about people with tumor and how we can help them using syntactic theory. And I'll end with something that we don't understand yet completely, but these are new data from this week that I want to share with you. Okay, so I'm going to start with some examples. This is a person who had a brain damage when he was 25. And I'm showing him this picture. And I'm telling him, which cat is the dog? Do you see there are two cats here? Which cat is the dog biting? And he tells me, could you say that again? And I try not to change my voice because I feel that way he will feel less embarrassed. And I say, which cat is the dog biting? And he says again, and I say it again, I will not demonstrate, but six times. And then he says, Well, it's a bit, I understand, but not exactly. And then I ask, what did you understand? And he says, I understood cat, dog, bite. But what? The sentence, not exactly. I listened, but I didn't. This is here, and this is here, there. This one here, and this one there. Try to think what he means, this one here, this one there. Cat, I understood. Dog, I understood. Bite, I understood. But the sentence, no. And then I said it again. And then he asks me if I can say it slowly. I say it slowly. He succeeds. He has 50% success rate. And then we celebrate together. Yoo-hoo. And the question is, why exactly was this sentence so difficult? So why? What makes which cat is the dog biting a difficult sentence? So I'm sure you have a beginning of ideas. I'll show you two other examples of other populations, and then we'll try to find out what the generalization is. So this is a task of comprehension, but this time, before it was which cat is the dog biting, it was a question, and now it's a declarative sentence, maybe show me the woman that the girl draws, and we have a woman drawing a girl and a girl drawing a woman. And this is a girl with a developmental language impairment, and she tells me, say it again. What? And I say it again, and she says, I don't know. Here, and she points to the picture. Here the girl is drawing the woman, and here the woman is drawing the girl. Could you ask again? Do other children know? So she feels that nothing in the sentence helped her understand if it is the girl who's drawing the woman or the woman who's drawing the girl. So let's look at the sentence. Show me the woman that the girl draws. What makes this sentence difficult? I'll give you one other example, and this is an example. I showed you examples in comprehension, now an example in production. And this is a girl who was treated since she was 4 because something was not working out in kindergarten and then in school, and she was very well treated, but nobody knew what the problem was. She entered my lab like that. She didn't make eye contact. And some people thought she had ASD. She didn't. And then I told her, imagine there are two girls. A butterfly touches one girl. A mosquito touches one girl. Which girl would you rather be? And then she said, I would rather be a butterfly. Okay? She probably wanted to say, I would rather be the girl that the butterfly touches, but she couldn't. Now let's see what's common to, I would rather be the girl that the butterfly touches, and the girl that the woman draws, and which cat does the dog bite. There is something similar to all these sentences, and when we look at sentences that are difficult and sentences that are relatively easy to populations with this kind of syntactic impairment, we see that the sentences that I just said are difficult, but the girl kissed grandma, or the girl that kissed grandma, or who kissed grandma, is easy. So what is the generalization? You can see that on the left, the sentences, something about the order of the constituents in the sentence is different, right? So we have the theme, the person who is influenced by the action, appearing before the agent of the action, right? And on the right, we see the agent coming before the theme, and there is something about that. Now let's look for a second at syntactic theory. Meanwhile, in syntactic theory, there are theoretical constructs. For example, we can talk about the theta criterion, saying every verb, for example, the verb draw, has an agent and a theme. Every verb has to give its roles to the noun phrases in the sentence. And every noun phrase in the sentence has to have a role. So everything is happy in the sentence, the girl draws the woman, the verb gives the agent to what comes before it, and gives the theme to what comes after it. Now what happens to the theta criterion when we have a sentence like, this is the woman that the girl draws? So the verb wants to give the theme role, it doesn't have a theme role afterward, it doesn't have a noun phrase afterwards, and the woman doesn't have a role. So how do we satisfy the theta criterion? The idea is that we have syntactic movement. So the idea is that when we have something like which girl the woman kissed, or this is the girl that the woman kissed, we have a syntactic movement, which means that actually the element is interpreted in the object position, in the theme position, but it appears in the beginning of the sentence. This is something that doesn't have to do with language impairments at all. It is a theoretical construct, syntactic movement. And this is syntactic movement, okay? We have the theme of the action moving to the beginning of the sentence. It's called syntactic movement. And then what we have to do is to know that when the noun appears in the beginning of the sentence, it actually was born after the verb. And then we have to make these calculations and to give it the role of the theme, even though it appears before the agent and not after the verb. And if we have, so we have syntactic movement, and then we have a small adjustment. Not every kind of syntactic movement is difficult in these populations. This is a paper that we wrote, that Luigi Ritz and Adriana Belletti, who are here with us, that we wrote about language acquisition, but it turns out to be a very useful generalization also for other populations, is that not every kind of movement is problematic, but when the theme moves across the agent and they are both full noun phrases, then it's a problem. So you can think about it as some kind of interference. You can see that, do you see the arrow? And you see that the blue square is interfering. It's really interfering. It's a movement with interference. So from now on, I'm going, I demonstrated it, okay. See? Interference. So from now on, every time I show you a structure with interference, I use this symbol. I try to remember to use this symbol to show you that this is a structure with this kind of interference. And there are various kinds of sentences of this type. Like, for example, this woman, the girl, draws. In some of the languages that you speak here, it's more acceptable. In English, it's a bit less acceptable. Relative clauses like, this is the woman that the girl draws. And questions like, which woman does the girl draw? In all these cases, we have movement with interference. So we are using linguistics as some kind of toolbox in order to explain difficulties. Now I'm going back to the impairments. Talking about individuals with acquired deficits, in this case, agrammatism, so people with language impairments with aphasia after brain damage who show specific problems with syntax. And when we look at the types of sentences that they find difficult to understand, we can use, for example, pictures like that. And we compare sentences with this kind of crossing movement and without crossing movement. We see that, so for example, show me the grandmother the girl kissed versus show me the girl that kissed grandma. We see very, very clearly that they find it very difficult to understand sentences with this kind of crossing movement, but they are able to understand sentences without this kind of movement. What does it mean? It means that when I tell them, show me the grandmother the girl kisses, they don't know which of the scenarios is matching the sentence that they just heard. Okay? And this is exactly what we heard with RA in the beginning. They said, I understood here in this case, I understood grandma, girl, and kiss, but I don't know who does what to whom in the sentence. And the same when we ask questions that involve this kind of movement, they find it very difficult to understand questions like, which elephant does the boy wash? But they do understand sentences like, which elephant washes the boy, because there is no interference in the movement. Now, it's not only in comprehension. Even when we ask them to repeat a sentence, we can see exactly the same thing. And this is, again, RA, this guy who understood cat, dog, and bite, is a very opinionated guy, and he doesn't like me to give him sentences. We have many years of connection, and he just doesn't want me to keep on bringing him sentences that he would not, that he thinks that are not good. So I asked him to repeat the sentence, I saw the girl that the woman drives, and he explains to me why the sentence is really bad. And he says, what, this and this, woman and girl, what? I saw the girl, okay. So what? I saw the girl, okay. That the woman dries? He's reading, he took my page and he's reading from my page. What do you mean? I don't know. And then I tell him, it means that the woman dries the girl. He says, what? 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 No. Dries? No. Dry, what dries? What? Woman? What? Woman, girl, what? Because he doesn't know what, he has the verb dries, he has theta criterion, he knows that someone has to be dried here, and he doesn't know who it is, okay? And he was just asked to repeat the sentence, but given that he is unable to process it, as is unable to understand the sentence, he can't repeat it. Okay, I'll just say in parentheses, that this kind of deficit in movement might be really a deficit in the movement, but it also might be a deficit in constructing the syntactic tree, the top parts of the syntactic tree that are necessary for this kind of movement. I will not go into it now. Okay, so we see in acquired deficits, we see problems in all kinds of structures that involve movement. What about developmental cases? But I would like to show you that once we understand what kind of sentences are difficult, we are much better able to assess people who have children who have problems, including children who were never diagnosed with a language impairment, just with a learning disability or problems in school. If we have the right generalizations, then we have the right kinds of sentences to put in a test, and then finally we understand why it's why things are difficult for them. Like why that came to my office like that. She was not autistic. She did not make eye contact because she couldn't understand what people were talking to her. She didn't want to produce sentences. So she just refrained from eye contact. So this is a study that we did with 275 children and adolescents with developmental impairments, Hebrew speakers, and with 47 Palestinian Arabic speakers. And we tested them with these structures. And you already can predict what happens when we present to them which elephant does the boy wash. You see that there is this kind of movement with interference, and indeed, they find it very difficult to understand these kind of sentences, and the same with questions. So questions like, which girl is grandma kissing? They don't know if the girl is kissing grandma or grandma is kissing the girl. And we see exactly the same pattern in Palestinian Arabic. When we use structures with movement with interference, they find it very difficult to understand. And this is in comparison to first graders, okay? So these are children who are between fourth grade and 12th grade, and actually between fourth grade and 21 years old, so not children anymore, and in comparison to first graders, and they find it really difficult to understand these structures. And even when we show the sentence in writing, they find it difficult just as well. And this is, I'll skip this example. I just want to give you this, the feeling of, I think, how they feel when they say, I know cat, I know dog, I know bite, but I don't know what's going on. I'll ask you, who saw whom, who, and who hit whom in this sentence? It's a grammatical sentence. What do you say? Just cherish this feeling, because I think this is what they feel when they see the sentence, which girl did the grandma kiss, okay? The problem is that we have to hold, we are normal if we don't understand this sentence, okay? The normal system cannot process this kind of double embedded relative clause. But it's just to demonstrate that. And then we start moving to the conscious, where Leonel Nagash talked about moving to the conscious thought. So we start going to a conscious strategy. Okay, so let's draw this kind of menorah, trying to understand who did what to whom. And this is very similar to what they are doing when they try to decipher a sentence. And I told you also that it applies also for relative clause production. Does it go away? So what we did was testing many children in different ages. And at least in Israel, at the age of 9, they don't get support. Usually, children don't get support of speech therapists. So The feeling is that probably it's something that is just for children and then it goes away. So let's see if it goes away. We tested children in all these age groups, and you can see the SLIs are the children with syntactic impairments are the interesting color, so orange. And you can see that in all these ages, the structures with movement are difficult and they remain difficult. So if we don't treat them, they stay difficult. Okay? It's really really crucial to know that there is a problem and then to treat the problem. Okay, another, just one thing that I want to say in, maybe in parentheses, even though it's five slides, but I do want to say it in parentheses, is that even though I see syntax everywhere, not every language impairment is syntactic impairment. Okay, so there are, when we talk about developmental impairments, language impairments, some of them are really syntactic impairments, but others might be problems in lexical retrieval, problems in phonology, maybe problems in pragmatics, problems in semantics, and it's really crucial to assess the different domains. So it is crucial for a child to get the right treatment and the right education to know what the problems are, and it's also crucial for us, I think, theoretically. Because if we know that there are dissociations, so if we test these all these domains and we see that there are children who are impaired, children with developmental impairments from birth, who are impaired in syntax but not in lexical retrieval, or children who are impaired in phonology or in phonological working memory but not in syntax, then we learn something about the organization from birth of these domains. And I'm happy to tell you that we tested many, many children with a very broad assessment battery. And what we see is that there are many children who have problems. So we see a double dissociation between syntax and lexical retrieval. We see a double dissociation between syntax and phonological working memory. So a child can be very impaired in phonological working memory and still have very good comprehension of movement, for example, and vice versa. We see a double dissociation between reading impairments, so dyslexias, and syntax. We see a double dissociation between lexical retrieval and phonological working memory, lexical retrieval and reading. So theoretically, these domains can be selectively impaired. Clinically and educationally, we need to pay attention to each child and draw a profile with a very fine line in order to know what's wrong, and then to know how to treat and how to educate. And now people might say, okay, so what's they don't understand object relatives with two full noun phrases. Is it that bad? So I claim that it is, and I bring empirical evidence. So the two questions are, first of all, are sentences with this kind of movement common? And the second question is syntactic impairment that common? So is it really important to dwell on that? So first of all, yes, it's very frequent. One of the things that we've done, and we call it work, is sit with children's books and books of children in first and second grade and just count sentences with movement. And we did it for Palestinian Arabic and for Hebrew, and and Palestinian Arabic and Standard Arabic, actually. And what we found is that something like a third of the sentences, both in Hebrew and in Arabic, were actually sentences with this kind of movement. So if a child does not understand movement, then they are up for a big challenge in school and in everyday life as well. So this is just an example from a math textbook, and this is what the child is requested to do. Color the parts that in them, the results that you got in exercise 1 and 2. If you're not mistaken, you got a snake. So how many children with syntactic impairments will get a snake with these kind of instructions? They might understand math very, very well, but they will not be able to make it with this kind of comment. Now, what about how frequent is it? How frequent are these syntactic impairments in children with, for example, learning disabilities? So I was lucky enough, and maybe the children in these schools were lucky enough, the head of a chain of schools of learning disabled children, who are children who have normal IQ, but still They fail in school and nobody knows why, so they get the title learning disabilities. How do you treat learning disabilities? I have no idea. So you have to know what the learning disability is. Learning disability just means that there is a problem, okay? This is when you start testing it more carefully. And the head of this chain came to me and said, I feel that we're missing something. I don't know what. And I heard that you have many, many tests. So maybe we can, maybe you can help us. Maybe we can understand what the problem of these children is. So what we did was a very broad assessment of two whole schools, one of 100 children and the other something similar, where we tested various language domains. Oh, I hope you didn't see it. We tested syntax and lexical retrieval and phonology and reading and phonological working memory. And do you want to guess? And these are, none of these children got a diagnosis of syntactic impairment. Do you want to guess what the percentage of children in this school was that had a syntactic deficit in movement? You know. It was huge, right. Okay, I will not let you guess, but I will tell you that it was 86%. So children sit in this school, they get the title of learning disability, but actually they have syntactic problems, and these syntactic problems can be treated, but we need to know that they have a syntactic deficit, because many of them got the diagnosis of attention deficit, and they got methylphenidate that is given very... graciously, I don't know, that is given to children in Israel to treat attentional problems, but they didn't have any attentional problem. They had problems sitting in class because they didn't understand what was going on. So it is very common. Both movement structures are common and syntactic impairments are common, so we really need to take it into account. Okay. So what we could do is we could treat these children. And what we actually do is we treat them like little linguists, and we explicitly teach them about movement, and we color the agent and the theme, and we show them with cards or with other ways that actually things can move in the sentence and keep their roles in the sentence. We draw each of the agent is yellow and the theme is orange. I will not get into the details, but I can give you papers showing how we do it. And what we see is a significant improvement. And we do this treatment both at the individual child level and at the group level. So these are classes that we teach, in which we teach movement. And in the beginning, none of them understand, we select them that way. They don't understand structures with movement. And by the end of the treatment that this wonderful Ronit Sterman is doing, what we can see is that they actually do understand structures with movement. And we see here out of this group, only three children showed no improvement and many did. And if you remember why, who preferred to be a butterfly, I told her when she was in my lab, I told her, you know, you're a very intelligent girl, you read very well, you find words very, very well, you just have problems with sentences that are not in the regular order, and you can treat it if you want. And she went for 3 months to a speech therapist, a very good one, who was working on this movement, and then she sent me a letter. And in the letter, she said that finally she understands what's going on in class, and she even has two friends. She never had friends, and now she has two friends, and nobody is afraid to sit next to her in the bus. And the first thing, of course, I started crying. The second thing, I called her mother, and I said, wow, it's so exciting how she improved. And her mother said, do you want to talk to her? Now, I know this girl doesn't want to talk to people. I said, if she agrees to talk to me, okay. And I talked to her, and I said, it's beautiful, the progress that you made following 3 months of syntactic treatment. Can I share this with my students? And I told her, you know, my students are special education teachers and speech therapists and psychologists. They would be interested in your story. She said, okay, do you want me to come and talk to them? And this is her standing with a microphone in front of 90 students, explaining to them with her finger, you should know that there is movement and there is embedding and there is a syntactic problem and it is possible to treat it. So I'm telling you, you should know that there is movement, there is syntactic, it's not the end of the talk, but it's the end of this part of the talk. There is movement, there is embedding, and there is a way to treat it once you know what the problem is. So the last part of my talk is going to be about movement and the brain, and specific populations with brain damage of various kinds. And starting with the typical fMRI, comparing structures with and without movement, we see that they are, as we are used to, blobs in the brain showing that there are areas that are more excited about structures with crossing movement than structures without. Now we see here our very good friends, you know, Brodmann, the IFG and the STG, and we are not surprised, but we also see the cerebellum, that we often, even if we see it in these fMRIs, we are not always talking about what we see. And when we saw this effect in the cerebellum, that the cerebellum is excited about movement, we said, okay, so patients who have a problem in the cerebellum, do they have a problem in syntactic movement? We know that they have a problem in movement, but syntactic movement? So we went to so there is a population called Machado Joseph ataxia. So these are people with a deficit, a neurodegenerative deficit in the cerebellum. We went to a hospital in Israel where all these individuals come to get treated. We talked to Carlos Gordon, the medical doctor who works with them, and he started laughing. Language? Why do you think language has anything to do with it? They have ataxia, they have a problem in movement. I said, okay, would you let me maybe try? He said, no, it has nothing to do with language, I tell you. I said, okay. And then I remember that people say there is a problem in sequencing. I said, can I test sequencing maybe? He said, okay, sequencing we know it's relevant to the cerebellum. So he let me test sequencing. Well, what is syntax if not sequencing? So I tested sequencing of words, but also I tested the syntax, and surprisingly, these individuals, they said they have, they are completely anosognosic. They said they have no problem in understanding sentences, but actually they have very severe problem. This is the percentage, sorry, it's percentage of errors. They have very severe problems in sentences with movement. So they have a deficit in the cerebellum and they show problems in language. Almost all of them. And then we continue in other populations and other neurodegenerative populations. We recently work with progressive aphasia and we test them for lexical abilities, reading, phonology, syntax. Out of 40 participants that were unselected, 36 showed syntactic movement problems. So it's a huge percentage. Many of them will not report, most of them will not report that they have a syntactic problem. They would say that they have a problem finding words, but when you see it, they see that they have problems finding words when they start a sentence as a sentence with movement. And you can see that they have different profiles. Some of them also have lexical problems, some of them have reading problems, some of them have phonological problems, but many, many of them have syntactic problems. So syntax should be assessed, not only in just listening to their spontaneous speech. Parkinson's disease, the same. Parkinson's disease, there are some studies showing that there is a problem in syntax. The reason I started working on Parkinson's is because some of my students are working with Parkinson's patients and I ask them, what are you working, speech therapist, and I ask, what are you working on? And they say voice. And I said, what about their language? And they say, well, we don't know. And then they said, yes, there are these groups of, we do group therapy, and there are those individuals with Parkinson's who are probably cognitively low, they said. Why do you think they are cognitively low, I asked. They say, well, they don't participate. We give commands and they don't do it. And then we started testing them and found out that 63% of them have syntactic problems. And then I gave instructions to the speech therapists to work with these groups, not to use structures with movement. Lo and behold, they started participating. The ones who were supposed to have cognitive problems actually didn't have cognitive problems. They had syntactic problems. And once the commands were phrased without movement, they were able to join the group and do what they were requested to do. The last part is another population where knowing syntax is to whom knowing syntax is relevant, and these are individuals with brain tumors. Individuals who have brain tumors. The tumors, I'm talking here about gliomas that press various parts of the brain tissue, might be very problematic and might give rise to a deficit that has to do with the place where the glioma presses. Now, what is usually done is surgery, and the problem is that when there is surgery for brain tumor removal, we want to make sure that we don't touch areas that are important. It's very difficult to say which areas in the brain are not important. So we want to make sure that important cortical areas are not affected. And of course, because we are not corticocentric, we also want to make sure that the white matter tracts are not affected in brain surgery. And here again comes a linguistic theory to our to assist us, and we can in brain during brain surgery, what we are doing is we run these kind of tests of syntactic movement, and we are not able to tell you about it because the time is approaching its end, but I can tell you that we can see using stimulations during brain surgery, we can see actually areas that you stimulate, and the patient, all of a sudden, the patient who had no problem in syntax before, all of a sudden cannot understand a structure with movement, or cannot produce a structure with movement, or cannot repeat a structure with movement. And this is very, very useful. Because when we tell the surgeon, okay, this area is an area of syntax, please stop, they can go from another angle, right? They can enter, they can get to the tumor from another side. And this is again how syntax is very, very useful and helps people. These are just examples, so I'm going to skip them. And I'm going to finish just by saying something about the Aslant. The Aslant tract, and this is what I promised to tell you about the very, very new data that we have, that we are still thinking about it, so maybe you can think about it together with me. There is a tract that is connecting the supplementary motor area with our beloved Broca's area. And it's known that when there is damage after, for example, brain surgery, when there is the damage in this place, especially in the supplementary motor area, people they can't speak for a week or two, and then legend has it, they improve. Okay, but when you talk to them, they say some of them, a third of them say, I still feel that something is off in my language and I don't know what. So I'll show you what. So what we did was comparing patients who had a deficit in the Aslant. I'm skipping, but I'll give you the important gist of the matter. Patients who had frontal tumors, those who had damage in the Aslant tract, and those who didn't have damage in the Aslant tract. And we compared their abilities to produce sentences. And what we see is a very, very, very clear difference between patients who had damage in the Aslant tract and those who didn't in the production of relative clauses. So they, like the girl who preferred to be a butterfly, they can't say, I would rather be the man that the butterfly touches. So what does this Aslant tract do? When we look at the other things, they don't have a problem in understanding these sentences. They don't have a problem in repeating these sentences. They don't have a problem in fluency, in noun fluency. They don't have a problem in naming. So what does it mean that they have a problem in producing this kind of complex sentences? What does this Aslant track do? We tested this also with stimulations, and what we see is that when they try to make this, to produce these sentences, they either repeat what I say, so instead of producing a new sentence, they just repeat the syntactic structure that I used, or they use the same syntactic structure that they used in the previous sentence. So instead of using an object relative, they would use indirect object relative that they just used before. So what does it mean? That it's very, very selective to the production of complex sentences. It means that the Aslant in some way is assisting in the construction of syntactic structures, of new syntactic structures. And when it cannot do what it is used to do, we use a construction that is already given to us by the experimenter or by us before. So the Aslant is crucial in something that has to do with the production of complex sentences, and it's really crucial to keep it. For example, in surgery, and here I finish, movement is an important construct in explaining developmental, acquired, neurodegenerative conditions. We can, once we understand that there is a problem in syntactic movement, we can help. And I thank my beautiful Language and Brain Lab people. I thank you, and I hope for peace now.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.